This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's show, medical marijuana, a lifesaver for some.
I know several people who could not live without marijuana, otherwise they will go blind.
A problem for others.
The people in mid-Michigan, I can tell you, are very upset that they did not want 48 dispensaries in Lansing.
4 years after voters said yes, we look at the confusing situation with medical marijuana in Michigan. We check on the race for president and talk to Michigan Supreme Court candidate Justice Brian Zahra.
Here we are a week out from the election, and still 75-80% of the people are undecided or don't know who they're going to vote for Supreme Court.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's show, 4 years have passed since Michigan voters decided to allow the use of medical marijuana in our state. Today we look at how things are faring with that law. And we'll get an update on how President Obama and Governor Romney's poll numbers are looking in Michigan. But first, Beaumont and Henry Ford Health Systems today announced plans to merge into one big nonprofit healthcare system. It's a blockbuster move that pairs two of Southeast Michigan's three largest health systems. In full disclosure, I want to tell you, I have in the past done some work with Beaumont Health System. So Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick brings the story to you.
The two healthcare providers have only signed a letter of intent thus far, but it's clear that unless some major hiccup emerges, they're moving full speed ahead toward a merger. It would become the region's largest healthcare system, with 10 hospitals, 200 patient sites, and nearly $6.5 billion in operations. Officials on both sides say larger trends in the healthcare industry are driving the merger. Nancy Schlichting is the CEO of Henry Ford Health System. She says hospitals are increasingly looking for economies of scale.
Clearly, one of the opportunities we have in coming together is to make sure that we do have a very efficient model for care. With the kind of payment reductions we expect to see over the next few years, it is essential that we have a larger platform.
Officials on both sides say the writing is on the wall. A growing emphasis on higher value, lower cost health care is pushing the industry toward integration. Henry Ford Hospital President and CEO John Popovich says the move will also help the two systems focus more on broader population health.
Combining these two national leaders in clinical excellence and patient safety will transform our focus from not only healing the sick, but to keeping people and our communities healthy.
Both system CEOs say there are no immediate plans to cut staff or close hospitals. The letter of intent lays out plans for combining the two systems' governance, staff, and research structures. They hope to finalize the deal by early next year. I'm Sarah Swick, Michigan Radio News.
It's T-minus six and counting. With Election Day less than a week away, latest polls in Michigan show that things are shifting. And if you've noticed a sudden burst of TV and radio commercials for President Obama and Governor Romney, that is certainly no coincidence. Joining us from Lansing is the editor and publisher of Inside Michigan Politics, Bill Ballinger, and Michigan Public Radio Network Lansing Bureau Chief, Rick Pluta. Hello, guys.
Hi, Cindy.
Hey, Rick.
Hi.
Good to have you with us. That brand new Detroit News WDIV poll, Rick's showing some rather important movement. So where does the race stand right now in Michigan?
Well, the Detroit news poll shows, Romney and Obama basically within the margin of error, saying that it's really a race and that Mitt Romney may be within striking distance of being the first Republican presidential candidate in five election cycles to take Michigan. We should point out that the Obama campaign this morning, David Axelrod, took issue with the Detroit News poll. He said that the reality is that they're still much further apart and called Mitt Romney's momentum fomentum.
As in F-A-U-X, as in phony.
Mm-hmm.
Gotcha. Bill, it does seem that that gap has shrunk and the momentum is moving toward Mitt Romney in our state. Why do you think that is?
I think it's happened nationally. In every state, you've seen a tightening. There was a poll last week in Michigan that actually showed it a dead heat, absolutely dead even. The poll that Rick is referring to showed a three-point margin for Obama. That is less, both those polls, much less than it was, obviously, a month ago. I think the debates were a factor. I think there's an intensity factor now. Actually, nobody believed this would happen in favor of Mitt Romney. So, you know, this is really very similar to 2004, where John Kerry, in all the polls, was ahead by about this margin a week out. And he ended up winning the state by about 3.5% over George W. Bush in 2004. But John Kerry was worried, and he came in here the Sunday before the election to campaign, just 2 days before the election. And this time, despite what Mr. Axelrod says, Obama is worried enough about Michigan that they are putting up $800,000 worth of ads on network and TV cable beginning this Thursday into Election Day.
Which the campaign says is prophylactic, that they're making sure that Michigan doesn't slip into that battleground country. But, you know, what we're seeing here is what a lot of people really expected, was that, you know, one, it was going to tighten up towards the end of it, and two, that come Election Day, it was really going to be about whoever had the better get out the vote machine to get their voters to the polls.
Well, do you really think the debates did make that much difference? It certainly seems that, you know, that double-digit lead that President Obama had here in our state after the Democratic convention, poof.
Oh, yeah, yeah. What happened in that debate was that the president created an opening for Mitt Romney to present himself as a viable alternative, that people actually saw this guy potentially as president where they hadn't before. And you could see that's where things started to shift, that's data driven, that's where we saw that it was starting to change.
Well, then, speaking of looking presidential, can either of you envision the fact that Mr. Obama could get a bump by being out there after Superstorm Sandy and being the president touring the Jersey Shore with Governor Christie? Do you think that could give him any kind of a bump?
That's always a question. Probably marginally it could. But when you say a bump, is there going to be a surge in national sentiment in favor of the incumbent president because of a storm on the East Coast? Hard to imagine that's going to make the difference in the race. Maybe psychologically it blunts the momentum that Romney seemingly was building up before the storm hit. The question is, will it recommence now, between now and next Tuesday?
Yeah, and in terms of the appearing presidential, if there is an advantage, and that's a big if, then it probably favors the president, who has the opportunity to, like you said, Cindy, go and, you know, step out and be presidential. You know, the other variable in there is that, you know, as the news coverage focuses on the storm and the response to the storm, does it do something to arrest the momentum that the Romney campaign is seeing?
I want to get back to talk about these commercials a little bit. We alluded to them earlier. Michigan really was all about Ohio. Michigan was not getting a lot of attention in recent weeks. No appearances and no commercials. And then suddenly Governor Romney's super PAC pumps over $2 million into those 11th-hour ads. Interesting how the Obama campaign mocked that as desperate just before word got out that they were buying ads in Michigan as well. Do you think that it's a little too late for all of that now for Michigan voters?
No. Well, let me just say, you mentioned the $2.2 million Romney-affiliated super PACs are pumping into ads right now, but the Romney super PACs have spent supposedly over $16 million in TV ads during the summer and fall here in Michigan. There's been a lot of advertising affiliated with Romney's candidacy over the past few months. It's not as though it's been absolutely silent here until this week. That's not the case. The only thing really missing is that Romney personally has not come to Michigan except once with Paul Ryan in August, just before the national convention, to Commerce Township in Oakland County. And Obama hasn't been here at all. So both candidates personally have ignored Michigan. And I keep saying, if Romney really hopes to win Michigan, he ought to show up at least once between now and next Tuesday. Heck, look at all the time he's spending in Ohio. If he's in Toledo, he could just step across the line into Monroe, the home of General Custer, and say, I'm in Michigan, where I was born and brought up. I think that might really help him between now and Tuesday.
We are not seeing the things that you would traditionally expect to see from either of the candidates, either of the campaigns, if Michigan were really being treated as a battleground state. And we should remember that the Romney Michigan strategy always had two tiers, that the top one was ideally it would be great if Mitt Romney could capture a blue-collar Midwestern state, you know, the blue-collar Midwestern state where he was born. But absent that, and perhaps, you know, somewhat more reasonably, at the very least, make the Obama campaign spend time, resources, money here that they wouldn't have spent otherwise in states like Colorado, Florida, Ohio, Pennsylvania.
What do you think, then, we should watch for here in Michigan, Michigan voters, over the next several days as this thing winds down?
I'd say a last weekend surprise. I mean, you may remember in 2000 when Al Gore and George W. Bush were running for the presidency for an open seat, and the last weekend was when the story came out about George W. Bush's drunk driving conviction years before. Remember that
yeah.
It never surfaced until that time. And most of the polls show George W. Bush leading marginally, very close, going into the last weekend, all of a sudden on Election Day, in the popular vote. As we know, Al Gore won by 500,000 votes. I always thought that made a big difference, and something like that could happen this weekend. We haven't seen the job numbers. They're coming out on Friday. That's going to be a pretty big factor, I think. If they go back up over 8%, headed in the wrong direction for the president, that could be a factor.
I think we keep an eye on Oakland County. Oakland County is kind of the Ohio of Michigan in this race. That the worst news that the Romney campaign got earlier in this cycle was that, you know, the place where he was raised, he was and still has a lot of family. There are a lot of Romneys in Oakland County. That he was still trailing there. That President Obama won Oakland County with 56% of the vote 4 years ago. It represented 13% of the total statewide vote, and it's really going to be a place where both of the candidates have to do well if they're going to win Michigan.
Anybody want to go on a limb right now, make any predictions? Does Michigan stay blue?
I predict that Obama will carry Michigan, but, you know, there could be a shocker on Tuesday. I think it's going to be close. I think it's going to be like 2004.
I think Bill is right that an upset is possible, but right now Michigan is still leaning blue in the presidential election.
Rick, Bill, thanks so much for talking with us today on Stateside.
My pleasure.
My pleasure.
Rick Pluta is Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network, and Bill Ballinger is the editor of Inside Michigan Politics. Still to come, should Michigan change its constitution to increase renewable energy use? We'll continue looking at the ballot proposals you'll find Tuesday, today. Proposal 3, coming up next on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Continuing our examination of the proposals on Michigan's ballot next Tuesday, we turn to Proposal 3, the renewable energy question. And who better to explain the pros and cons than Michigan Radio's Rebecca Williams, host of the Environment Report. Rebecca, so how would Prop 3 change state law if it becomes part of our state constitution?
So Proposal 3 seeks to amend the state constitution to increase the state's renewable portfolio standard. We have one of these on the books already, and it requires utilities to get 10% of their electricity sales from renewable sources, wind, sun, and so forth, by the year 2015.
Okay.
Now, that standard was put in place by the legislature in 2008. Proposal 3 would bump our standard up to 25% renewables by 2025. So that's why it's sometimes called 25 by 25, if you've heard that.
We have. Okay.
So the important thing to note is that Proposal 3 defines renewable energy sources as wind, solar, biomass, and hydropower. So there's four categories.
Okay.
Now, if Proposal 3 passes, it would be the first time that any state constitution would be amended for a renewable portfolio standard.
So I'm imagining that people across the nation are watching what happens here.
They are. Yeah, there's been a lot of interest in this.
All right. So that's what it may do. Who's for this?
So there's a group called Michigan Energy, Michigan Jobs. They're the group that is behind the ballot initiative. And now, of course, alternative energy companies supported a number of environmental groups and health groups. And organized labor is split on the issue.
Okay.
Former Republican Governor William Milliken supports it. Mm-hmm. Proposal 3 has just also been endorsed this week by former President Bill Clinton, of all people,
yeah.
and the Christian Coalition of America.
All right. And organized labor is split. Who else is against it?
So the utility companies are against this. So are many chambers of commerce. Dow Chemical has come out against it. Governor Rick Snyder is opposed. And also former state Supreme Court Justices Frank Kelly and Conrad Mallett, who are both Democrats, have come out and stated their opposition to Proposal 3 because they say it would muddy the Constitution. Here's Justice Mallett speaking at a press conference held by Care for Michigan. It's the group leading the effort to defeat Proposal 3.
These are very, very difficult, complex issues. They need to be discussed thoroughly and completely and in public. You can't make energy policy up on the back of an envelope. You can't shrink it down to a paragraph.
So his concern seems to be you can't just make a couple lines and slap it into a constitution and call that the change.
Yes, and everybody agrees that the legislature is going to have to do things to implement Proposal 3 if it passes.
Okay.
So there will be steps that the legislature has to take. There will be things the legislature will have to define. But when you put an amendment in the Constitution, if you wanted to change it in Michigan, it would actually take another constitutional amendment that we would have to vote on to make any changes to this Proposal 3.
Okay, so why exactly did the supporters want this to be a constitutional amendment instead of taking a legislative tack?
Well, they like the idea of cementing it in the Constitution. So the supporters say, you know, it took 10 years for the legislature to pass this 10% standard. So it takes too long, is their argument.
Okay.
Mark Fisk, who's the spokesman for Michigan Energy, Michigan Jobs, says they felt that if they left the legislature to its own devices, it would not raise the renewable portfolio standard anytime soon.
The big utility companies, the big oil companies, and the big energy companies have enormous clout and influence in our state legislature. And our coalition, bipartisan coalition, made the determination early on that the only practical way to expand Michigan's use of renewable energy was to let the people decide.
Okay, Rebecca, so how would things change for the average citizen in Michigan, let's say after next Tuesday, Proposal 3 is passed, and it is now in our Constitution?
Well, so people on both sides of this say that wind turbines are the most likely source, the most likely way that we would meet Proposal 3. But there's been a lot of debate about how much it would cost to implement. You've probably seen the ads. They're all over the airwaves.
They are.
We've been hearing from the opponents that it'll cost $12 billion over 20 years. And they use that 20-year figure as the lifespan of a turbine. And they estimate that each ratepayer in Michigan would pay about $2,500 over that time period.
Okay.
Now, the supporters of Proposal 3 do the math differently, and they look at how many ratepayers are residential. So this is households versus businesses.
Okay.
And what percentage of electricity they use. And they say, okay, well, the residential ratepayers use 40% of the electricity in the state. So if you take 40% of $2,500, it's $1,000. You with me there?
Okay.
And so then they take the $1,000 and they spread it over 25 years. So they look at the lifespan of a wind turbine as a little bit longer.
Okay.
So different math, right? And
yes.
So then they go further and they subtract out some fuel savings from burning less coal.
Okay.
And some avoided costs from not having to upgrade some old coal plants. And they come up with an average cost of 50 cents a month.
So we have, on one hand, $2,500 cost, and the other hand, 50 cents. That's certainly a great difference in price tags.
Yes, yes it is. So there's also a new report on Proposal 3 that's out from the University of Chicago. And I talked to Liz Moyer. She's the author of this report. And she says, hey, wait a minute. There's too many extremes on both campaigns on this issue. And her analysis is that Proposal 3 is doable with a moderate financial impact on consumers.
I think the take-home message is that this isn't dramatic on either side. It's not going to bankrupt Michigan. It's not going to save the world and stop global warming. It's not going to be free. It's not going to be disastrous. It's just another decision you have to make. It would be a little more expensive in Michigan. Some people would find that hard to take. It's not anything as expensive as trying to run your air conditioner in Hawaii. So it's people need to make a choice, and it is a valid choice on either side of the issue, and the choice has been complicated by a lot of rhetoric that's a little extreme.
Well said. And there's been a lot of extreme rhetoric.
and she says, at the most, if you pay $100 a month, let's say right now,
okay,
by 2025, your bill could go up to $111 a month to meet the new standard. But she points out that there's a rate cap in the proposal of 1% a year. And what that means is this 1% rate cap limits the amount that your bill can go up to meet Proposal 3. So actually, that means that your bill would go up more slowly than that. You know,
okay.
You have a gradual increase.
All right.
The important thing to note, though, is that that rate cap is not going to stop your bill from going up for other reasons. So electricity keeps getting more expensive, so your bill will probably keep going up no matter what.
This is just the part that would be involved with meeting the renewable standard.
Right.
All right. And there's this production tax credit, right, that's involving the federal subsidy for wind turbines?
Yep, that's right. And this is in place right now, but it's going to expire at the end of this year. And this federal tax credit has helped make wind turbine projects much more affordable. So one of the things that Liz Moore said to me was that if that goes away, if it's not extended at the end of the year, a lot of these renewable portfolio standards may become more expensive to meet and more difficult for states to accomplish. But her calculations, this $111 a month, includes the tax credit going away.
Okay. So the bottom line here for voters who are walking into that poll next, in that voting booth next Tuesday, what do they want to think about?
So the things to think about are you willing to pay more? And it's not completely clear how much more, but are you willing to pay more for more renewable energy? Do you think that that's where we should go as a state? Do you think that we should use less coal? We use about 59% of our electricity comes from coal, and that's imported from other states. Mm. So if that's important to you, that's one thing to think about. And then the other thing is, do you think that this kind of energy policy, a renewable portfolio standard, belongs in the Constitution?
And just so everybody's clear, too, because people will often say, I'm not sure if I vote yes, if that means yes or if it means no. So when you walk in and you look at Proposal 3, yes means?
Yes means I do want the renewable portfolio standard to go up to 25%.
And no means I do not. So that one is straightforward, the wording. There's no doubt there.
That's right.
Rebecca, thank you so much for enlightening us on Proposal 3. Rebecca Williams is, of course, host of the Environment Report here on Michigan Radio.
Thank you.
And a quick note now about these proposals, with a big thanks to stateside listener Dick in Ann Arbor, who wrote us to point out we had not yet mentioned how many votes it'll actually take to make these ballot proposals law. Well, the answer is a simple majority. If a majority of Michigan's voters say yes to one of these proposals, it'll pass. Let's continue now our conversations with the candidates for Michigan Supreme Court. Today, we're joined by Justice Brian Zara. Justice Zara, welcome.
Pleased to be with you.
Now, in the 2 years since you've been on the state Supreme Court, Justice Zara, can you spell out for us what's your approach to deciding the cases that come before you?
Well, I'll expand a little bit beyond the 2 years. I've been a judge now for 18 years. I was a young partner at the Dickinson Wright Law Firm, one of Michigan's larger and more prestigious firms, and the opportunity arose for me in 1994 to become a Wayne Circuit judge, and I left the law firm and took that opportunity because in my legal career, I encountered a number of judges who were either unwilling or unable to simply apply the law as it was written, and it was frustrating, and I thought I could make a difference. So I served 4 years in the Wayne County Circuit Court, and then I was appointed to the Court of Appeals, where I served 12 years there, and the past 2 years on the Supreme Court. And throughout those 18 years, I've always taken the approach that that judges need to say exactly what the law is, now if they think the law ought to be. That's the proper role of the judiciary. And in these 18 years, I really do feel I've made a difference and contributed substantially to Michigan's jurisprudence.
Justice Zara, what's your opinion and your views of future Supreme Courts overruling past high court decisions?
You know, every Supreme Court in our land, state, and the U.S. Has from time to time overturned prior decisions of the court. The Michigan Supreme Court is unique from all those other courts in that we actually have a case that defines what it is that we should look to before reversing a prior decision case. You start with whether it's rightly or wrongly decided, but if it's wrongly decided, that's still not enough to overturn it. You have to look at reliance factors to see whether the rule was relied upon, the wrongly decided rule has been relied upon, what effect it would have to change that rule. You look at how long it's been entrenched and what a change in the rule will do. Will it actually help to clarify the law, or will it further disrupt the law? So I think Michigan is unique in this regard because other Supreme Courts will just reverse it on a case-by-case basis without saying what standards they're using. We actually have a set of standards to determine when you should or shouldn't reverse prior precedent.
Justice Zara, what role do you think the judiciary should play in political issues in our state?
Yeah. You know, courts traditionally try to stay out of political issues. There's even a political question doctrine at the federal court. It's a little bit different at the state level, not that we get involved, but there, I think an appearance is created of political participation by virtue of the fact that Michigan is unique to all the other 50 states, and that Supreme Court justices are actually nominated by political parties and then run on a nonpartisan basis. I think this creates an appearance of partisanship, but the record of the court negates that appearance, at least for this court. And I can point to a number of cases over the past two years, to while I've been on the court, to support my conclusion. For example, one very political case was the recall election of Representative Paul Scott out of the Grand Blanc area. I don't know if you recall this, but shortly after the new taxes and the tax reform was passed by the governor, the MEA focused on a number of legislators for recall. One of them was Representative Paul Scott.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly on him because I think he served on some education committees in the state house. And they filed their petitions for recall, and then the Scott group challenged it in the trial court. The trial court said the challenge is not good. The recall election should go forward. It got to the Michigan Court of Appeals, and the Michigan Court of Appeals stopped the election, and so there would be no recall election. Now, it came to the Supreme Court, and as you know, the Supreme Court does not have to take any case. We're not an appeal by right court. And so if we were a partisan court, if we were a Republican court, we simply could have rejected taking that case, and there would have been no recall election. But this is a court that is governed by the rule of law, that's fidelity is to the law and not to any partisan issue. And we looked at the Court of Appeals opinion and concluded it was wrong on the law. Not only was it wrong on the law, but it related to a matter of elections. And this is an important issue for the people of the state of Michigan. And it's exactly the type of thing that the Supreme Court should take. And so we did take the case. And by order, we reversed the Court of Appeals. The recall election went forward. And Representative Scott was recalled. Now, this was not a Republican interest. This was really something that upset a lot of Republicans. But again, we're not a partisan court. We're not a Republican policy court. We're a rule of law court. And finally, it came to all these ballot proposals that we allowed to be on the ballot. I mean, collective bargaining is not what you'd call a Republican issue. But we looked at the law, and we said the parties who wanted this on the ballot complied with the rules. And therefore, we said it goes on the ballot. Again, this upset a lot of partisans. But we're not a court that does partisan work. We're a court that follows the rule of law. Again, our fidelity is only to the rule of law. So I would like to see a system perhaps where we did away with these party nominations because it does create an appearance that I think is not justified by the court's record.
That's actually what I wanted to go into a little more with you, because I seem to be hearing this across the board as I talk to other candidates. No one seems particularly happy with the system we have right now, where you have to raise money to run and be backed by a party, but yet you are nonpartisan. If you could make changes and overhaul the way you would run for a seat on the state Supreme Court, what would you like to see?
Well, here we are a week out from the election, and still 75 to 80% of the people are undecided or don't know who they're going to vote for Supreme Court. This is a very important court. It's a very important issue to the state of Michigan, and it's really unbelievable to me that we have this many people that are undecided. I personally think that judges should be appointed by the governor, and that the philosophy of the judge should be part of the gubernatorial election. Now, we can have Supreme Court judges serve for 16 years or until age 70 or 72 or 74. But in this way, we take out the need to raise funds out of the process. And I'm told people don't want to give up their right to vote. But when 75 or 80% of the people go into the voter's booth not even knowing who the candidates are, we really need to consider as a state whether this is the proper process. So my first choice would be to go to an appointment process.
Much like we have with the U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, a little bit different. Under Michigan's Constitution, we have some appointments that the governor makes, and the Senate can reject within 60 days. But if they don't reject within 60 days, the appointment goes through. I think that's much better than the federal system, where the Senate can hold these things up and drag them on for years. Now, one of the good things about party nomination is that there's no primary. Of course, if we go to the system like all other judges throughout the state, we're going to have to raise money twice. We're going to have to raise money when we have a primary, and then we're going to have to raise money for the general. So perhaps a system where we do away with partisan nominations
And anyone who wants to run for Supreme Court collects petitions like every other judicial position across the state, and then have no primary, just the top vote getter wins. That would be, I think, better than the system we have, but I still think the best system for the state of Michigan would be an appointment system by the unfettered discretion of the governor. And then every time we elect a governor, I mean, the people should be asking the governor, what type of judges do you intend to appoint?
Talk to the voters who are listening right now, Justice Brian Zahra, and tell them why you think you deserve to continue to hold a seat on the state's highest court.
Well, I'd reiterate, I've been a judge for 18 years, and I've tried to make a difference in that 18-year career. I've expressed throughout that time nothing but fidelity to the law. And I think this philosophy and this approach best serves the residents of the state of Michigan, because we're not going to be filling in the perceived gaps left open by the legislature. The people's right to self-govern is going to be preserved. It's going to be in the people they elect and send to Lansing, and the judges are only going to interpret the law. I've been a judge 18 years. I've stuck to this philosophy. I've received bipartisan support, so I think I'm intellectually honest. I call them as I see them, based strictly on the law, and I let the chips fall where they may. And I think no one can ask for anything more from a court or a judge.
Justice Brian Zahra, candidate to continue serving on the Michigan Supreme Court, we thank you for talking with us today on Stateside.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much.
And still to come, it has been 4 years since voters approved the use of medical marijuana in Michigan. We're going to take a look at where things stand on this controversial issue. That's coming up next on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's been just about 4 years since Michigan voters approved the use of marijuana in our state for medical purposes, and approved it by a pretty hefty percentage, 63%. So Michigan became one of 17 states permitting medical marijuana use. The law removed state-level criminal penalties for using, possessing, and growing marijuana by and for patients whose doctors have okayed the medical use of marijuana for them. In the ensuing 4 years, there seems to have been what is arguably a lot of confusion for patients and for the medical marijuana industry, the ones who are growing and providing the marijuana. So we wanted to take a look at where things stand today for medical marijuana and what the future looks like here in Michigan, especially if you're someone who wants to use marijuana to alleviate pain or debilitating symptoms. Joining us now from Lansing is State Senator Rick Jones of the 24th District. That includes Allegan, Berry, and Eaton counties. And for our listeners who may not know Senator Jones's background, he spent 33 years in law enforcement, including more than 30 years with the Eaton County Sheriff's Department. And we're joined by attorney Matthew Abel. He's been defending clients facing marijuana charges for some 20 years, and he's a leader in the movement to legalize marijuana. He is the statewide director of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, or NORML. Welcome to both of you. Senator Jones, I want to start with you. Right now we have over 121,000 Michiganians who are active, registered, qualified patients. Could you outline for us just how Michigan's program is designed to work for those people already registered and for the people who want to be able to use marijuana as a medicine?
Well, there's a great deal of confusion now because the ballot initiative was very gray when it was written. It left a lot of confusion in the law. And so currently you can have grow your own plants, or you can have a caregiver. And a caregiver can have up to five patients.
And the process of being approved to obtain marijuana, how does that work, Senator Jones?
Well, currently you have to see a doctor. There is legislation that would not allow the online services. You would have to actually see a doctor personally, not do something over Skype, and personally be examined and have a relationship with a doctor that prescribes the marijuana for you.
All right. Mr. Abel, from what you're hearing, how is the state system working for patients?
Well, not as well as it could be. Certainly, my law partner and I sued the state just recently for failure to file the annual report that is now 3 years overdue, for failure to consider new conditions where we have veterans who filed applications for post-traumatic stress. And the law requires that when such a request is made, that there a panel be convened and a decision made within 6 months. And it's been 3 years on that. That's extremely unfair to our veterans who've served our country and deserve the law to be enforced the way it was written.
Who has any sense as to why it's taken so long and there's this backlog?
Well, it's clearly a stall. There's no explanation for it.
Senator Jones, especially for the veterans, what would be a reason? I know you say there's a lot of confusion in the law.
My understanding that the cards have been updated, and now they're doing the cards in a timely fashion. This is the first time I've heard of a complaint on not having some sort of panel to examine new conditions.
The review panel.
I find that hard to believe, Senator.
I haven't had any complaints filed with my office.
There have been over 100 requests for new conditions filed when it was FOIA'd 6 months ago, actually.
Okay, well, again, I'm not the health department, and I don't know anything about this. I'm sure you did file these complaints. I would support a panel to examine new conditions, but I also think the panel must examine conditions that are in the law that should not be there. And a very good example is glaucoma. I've had numerous experts from the University of Michigan and other experts from around the state come in and testify. They have had patients that stopped their eye drops, only used marijuana, and went blind. And they want it removed from the law.
Senator, I challenge you to produce one such patient. I think that's baloney. And on the converse, I know several people who could not live without marijuana. Otherwise, they will go blind.
I did see in some research that that stance is supported by the Michigan Society of Eye Physicians and Surgeons and also other eye experts.
Actually, the issue is a little more nuanced than that. Mm-hmm. There are two major types of glaucoma, open-angle glaucoma and closed-angle glaucoma. And I believe it works better for one than the other. And that is what needs to be explored.
It sounds, again, like a need for a review panel to be someone to kind of oversee this is long overdue and part of the confusion.
Well, it'd be nice if we looked at the science. Yes.
I would be happy to support a panel that could add conditions but also remove conditions that are inappropriate.
So far, that's not written in the law. The only thing that is there in the law is the panel that's required to consider the request for new conditions. There is no mechanism to remove conditions other than what Senator Jones is attempting.
With a bill. Let me ask both of you, and I'll start with you, Senator Jones. You began by saying there's a lot of confusion with this. Where do you see are the biggest inherent problems of Michigan's Medical Marijuana Act?
Well, currently we have felons that are acting as caregivers. I think that's completely inappropriate. We don't want a felon going to, if you did have a senior citizen that was in the last stages of their life, and they wanted the marijuana, I do not object to that. But do we want a felon going into their home and delivering this product? I don't think so. So I think that needs to be cleared up very carefully in the law.
That's why we need dispensaries where people can go and obtain medicine.
I'd like to have him finish, and then I want to
decide that. You know, the dispensaries were a huge problem. We had 48 in Lansing. They put them up next to schools with big flashing marijuana signs. They put them up next to churches that had rehab for drug rehab programs. So the people in mid-Michigan, I can tell you, are very upset. They did not want 48 dispensaries in Lansing.
I actually heard a report on NPR about in California when the crackdown came on dispensaries in California. And mothers describing that people were coming out of dispensaries and lighting up in front of her house with her child. Should there be parameters?
As if people don't come out of liquor stores and crack open a pint of whatever. This is a zoning issue. Mm-hmm. It's an issue that should be determined by the local governments. And where dispensaries should be located should be determined according to time, place, and manner, just like any other business or controversial business.
Is some of this the confusion, that medical marijuana use is still illegal under federal law, so are we just kind of, is the whole umbrella of the whole system undermining, trying to make this an effective law?
We do need to change federal law. There's no doubt about it. And that can only happen through the Congress or through rescheduling through the Drug Enforcement Administration.
If there's a federal law change, then I would support taking medical marijuana, putting it into a pharmacy, and dispensing it that way through a legitimate doctor than having the patient go to the pharmacy. What we have now...
We can do that when we put alcohol in the pharmacy.
Well, what we have right now is the Wild Wild West, and we have a number of people who went to card mills, got a card, and are simply using the product for recreational use. And that's not what the people of Michigan voted for.
Now, Matt, I want to hear your side, too, your sense of the areas of the greatest confusion and the greatest problems with the system in Michigan as it stands now.
The lack of respect for the law on the part of law enforcement and the prosecution.
Very uneven?
Very uneven, especially in Oakland County, for example. They're prosecuting way too many cases on that are borderline issues, and it's gotten to the point where if you are a medical marijuana patient and you live in Oakland County, if there is any, you know, if you leave your grow room unlocked to go answer the door, you could end up being charged with a felony. It's like that. I mean, that can happen anywhere in Michigan, but in Oakland County, they actually charge you with that.
Senator Jones, as someone who has been in law enforcement before becoming a lawmaker, why the uneven enforcement?
Well, because the enforcement depends on the stance of the prosecutor of 83 different counties. And some counties, you have a stance where they don't want to enforce the law, and in some counties, they want to take action. And so it's a huge problem.
For someone who's listening who has one of these conditions, cancer, HIV positive, Crohn's disease, hepatitis or ALS, a number of these conditions that are defined in the Michigan law. What do you see as the outlook for them? If they want to obtain relief by using medical marijuana, for each of you, what's the future hold for the patients? I really want to focus on what it means to the patients and to the people who love them.
To me, the more that we can normalize this and have the medical marijuana lab tested so that people can know the percentage of cannabinoid content in the various products. There's THC is the main thing, and it's what gets people high. But the other main medical ingredient they think so far is cannabidiol, CBD. And CBD has really good properties, especially for neural issues. But they find that it works best when the ratio is about 1-to-1 on those. What's happened, though, the recreational users over the last 75 years that marijuana mm-hmm. has been illegal have been breeding marijuana for high THC content to the point where there is hardly any CBD left. It's at 0.1% or something. And so there are some rare strains out there, something that's called Cannatonic that has a 1-to-1 ratio. It's 20% THC and 20% CBD. And those are extremely valuable strains for medical marijuana patients. And we need to do more research into what the different flavonoids and terpenes actually do, whether they're related to the health conditions. There's a lot of science yet to be done. I wish the medical community would begin to embrace this and take a look at it.
And it really hasn't?
It really hasn't. It's a darn shame. I don't understand. I believe there are topical properties dealing with the skin that need to be looked at. There are some studies showing that marijuana used that way has anti-carcinogenic properties, that it will surround the cancer cells and kill them. Now, if that's not worth research, I don't know what is.
Hmm. What about your view, Senator?
Well, I'm all for research, and I do think that any marijuana that is sold as medical marijuana should be tested. Right now, you have no idea what you're getting. It could have bug spray on it. It could have been grown in soil with heavy metals. Somebody may have improperly stored it, could have mold on it. And so if somebody with cancer whose immune system has been compromised uses this product, they could have terrible, deadly consequences. So I would support that marijuana was tested.
Perhaps we could work together for some legislation that would allow laboratories. There are now at least 5 laboratories that are operating in Michigan that test medical marijuana. I'm sure they would feel much safer if there was some legislation authorizing their existence.
I just have to wonder, as someone standing on the outside and looking in, How is it that a lot of this was not already in place before it became law? I mean, it was voted in November, it becomes a law in December, and it seems like the underpinnings just weren't there. If people don't know what they're getting and they have to experiment with different kinds and you're not sure if there's bug spray on that, how did it get through without having the proper underpinnings?
Well, I think the committee that drew up the ballot initiative purposely wrote it very gray. And because they simply want to legalize marijuana. But the way it was sold to the people of Michigan when they voted on it, would this be a product that seniors in their last stages of life and horrible pain or would cancer would want this product? And so it passed. But now that people in mid-Michigan have seen 48 dispensaries go up in Lansing, I can tell you if it were back on the ballot, they would not be voting for it in those overwhelming numbers.
I think now that people have seen how medical marijuana works for grandma when she eats a brownie and can sleep at night, that they would vote for it in higher numbers. And furthermore, I disagree with the conceptualization that the law was vague in any manner. It was written in a broad manner to protect patients, and the Supreme Court of Michigan has seen that in the King decision, where they authorized the use of either the defense with a card or an affirmative defense. That had been fought hard for 3 years where we were denied the affirmative defense. The Supreme Court unanimously laid that out, that that's available to patients as a protection.
Senator, your view, what needs to be done to make this just a more effective law for patients?
Well, obviously, you know, I would like to see a federal law change if we're going to have marijuana used as a medical product, and I would like it to be tested. I'd like it to be handled as any other pharmaceutical drug, and I think that would be appropriate. I would like to see patients that want this, that have appropriate diseases or conditions of the body, be able to get it through a pharmaceutical situation. At the pharmacy, I'd like the product to be carefully inspected to make sure it's safe, and I'd like to make sure that we have legitimate doctors prescribing this. I do believe there are some cases where it's okay, and I said that when we were debating this law. However, what we have now are many people that have obtained cards, I believe, simply for recreational use, and I don't think that's appropriate, not what the voters of Michigan really want.
All right, Matt, your thoughts on what needs to be done to make this more effective for patients?
I think the government just needs to follow the law. We could start with that. And people need to understand that prohibition does not work. It never has. It's been 75 years, and we're spending precious government resources when less than half of the violent crimes are solved, but the drug crimes are solved at huge amounts. This is a public health problem, not a criminal justice problem. It's being addressed in a wrong-headed manner. Marijuana prohibition needs to be repealed. There's nothing wrong with the responsible use, recreational use of marijuana by adults. Marijuana is safer than alcohol.
Thank you so much. We've had attorney Matt Abel with us, and then we've also had Senator Rick Jones from the 24th District, State Senator Jones. Thanks very much to both of you.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Have a great day.
And let's wrap up today with a quick update on those in Michigan who've been affected by Superstorm Sandy. Some 35,000 people throughout our state are still without power. More than 150,000 homes and businesses initially lost their electricity because of the monster storm. DTE Energy says the remaining outages are widely scattered, and it will still take several days before all customers will get their service restored. And, of course, our thoughts here at Stateside are with all of those in Michigan and along the eastern seaboard who have been so affected by the storm. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Contributors are Allie Billings, Ellen Cortezoa, Cameron Stewart, and Mercedes Mejia. Stateside is engineered by Bob Scon. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening, and we will talk to you at 3 o'clock tomorrow.